I mean, sounds pretty cool. This is a interesting fortress.
Yeah.
Switchback stone cut pathway winding up, and then these kind of funky characters that the Pukulmen, I don't know what to compare them to. They sound
What?
like, well, I'm thinking of references outside of Lord of the Rings.
Oh, well, no. Think of references in Lord of the Rings.
They remind me of the maybe like the carvings of dwarves at Moria or the Lonely Mountain. But I don't know, what am I missing?
No, I'm not gonna tell you if you can't get
Oh
it.
man. Oh well. Tough. Patrick, it has been a while,
Dude, it's been a super while.
but we're back in force.
So we're finally just in the swing of releasing a bunch of episodes that we've had stored, or that I've had stored up. Not really Clifford, but I've had stored up. And it's one of them we talked about like what time of year it was, and it was like springtime. It's getting released now. It's pretty bad, so I bet, I'm wondering how late this one will be in comparison, but I don't know. Yeah, it's been a while. Lots of changes and everything, but I don't know. You got something to talk about, or we could just jump in. I know.
Let's see, you've relocated. You're
Yeah.
back in Chicago.
I am back in Chicago.
In the homeland. I'm still out in San Francisco.
Yeah.
But yeah, what?
Now we have a 2 hour difference, so
I
we'll see how this goes.
know.
But it's still sunny for you, so that's kind of cool.
I know.
Yeah. You what? You ran a marathon? I guess we
Yeah, I
should
ran a
really,
marathon 2 days ago.
yeah.
Went pretty well. I got 46th place, which I'm pretty excited
Nice,
about.
nice. Yeah.
Other than that, things are pretty much as they've been. COVID summer number two.
Yeah, I guess I don't know. I'm kind of declaring it over. So it's just yeah. That's it. Yeah, I don't know. We could probably catch up more or like it's honestly like brutal to hear how late these things are coming out like after we've done them. I mean, like it's not even like we just recorded some of these in spring. It was like early spring. I mean, it was bad. It was like pre it was April. Bad, and
Oh
now it's
man.
finally coming out, so
Well, okay.
yeah. Well, what are we doing today?
Today we have chapter three of book five of The Return of the King. This is the Muster of Rohan.
Oh, yeah, okay. Why don't you give us Cliff's Notes first? Then we're gonna do some draft talk, then we'll do some feelings talk, and then we'll start diving into all the cool parts of the chapter. But this one was pretty straightforward, I would have to say, for tonight. Not to say it'll be short, but this one was more straightforward than most chapters, I would say. But yeah, why don't you hear his Cliff's Notes?
So, we pivot back to Rohan, where Merry has been riding with Théoden back towards Dunharrow. This is shortly after Aragorn, Legolas, and Gimli had departed to speed ahead on their way to Gondor. In Dunharrow at dusk, Théoden, Éomer, Merry, and the other riders convene with the Rohirrim forces gathered there in secret. Éowyn reveals that Aragorn and his companions have gone into the mountains to seek the paths of the dead. Though this strikes fear into the Rohirrim hearts, Théoden speculated that perhaps this is the time that had been prophesied where men could pass through said paths. In Dunharrow, a messenger from Gondor formally requests that Théoden send his forces to Minas Tirith as soon and as quickly as possible, speculating that a siege will begin in a few days' time. Though Gandalf had already prepared the Rohirrim for this march, Théoden heeds the messenger's advice and makes his forces ready to march at first light of the next day. When the army passes Meduseld / Edoras, Merry is told he can go no further. Théoden wants him to stay behind. But a friendly, secretive soldier named Durnhelm offers to take him along, and they follow the army into the east.
Okay. Ooh. Wonder. Yeah. All right. Lots to talk about. But before this, felt like this would be a good chapter, and probably because it's possibly the only chapter of book five where we could, you know, devote time to this. But I thought it'd be a good time to talk about some of the drafts, Tolkien's writing process, all this stuff. Because the last time we really actually talked about it, I believe, was like when we met Faramir. Like, met him
before.
So it's been a while. Besides that, we did mention that he would take a long break in between books four and five because he didn't know how he was going to get Frodo out of the tower, if he was even going to get him out, you know, to be determined, right? But anyways, he finished up that Choices of Master Samwise chapter, which is the last one of book four. He finished that in around November of 1944. And he sent the script off to the publisher, and he sent with it a broad strokes outline of what he was planning for Return of the King, which he thought would only be one book, so book five. You know, he always underestimates it, right? But to his credit, always to his credit, of course, but extremely to his credit, at the end of the outline he wrote, you know, like, not even a break, not even like a paragraph break or anything. He just went straight into this. He said, it will probably work out very differently from this plan when it really gets written, as the thing seems to write itself once I get going, as if the truth comes out then, only imperfectly glimpsed in the preliminary sketch. Kind of cool. Any thoughts on that?
I mean, I feel like we've talked about that a little bit before.
Right.
He just goes for it. Some bits of the story feel like he just powers through in one go. Definitely he went back and revised stuff, but it's not like he did a grand outline and worked backwards and filled in all the pieces. It was a train going along.
Yeah, and that was kind of why we really didn't focus on it because we didn't have time, but for most of book four, he actually kind of got a lot of it, but then I think it was kind of like the Shelob chapters. He might have needed to do like a little bit of drafting work and stuff or iterations of it, but we didn't have time to talk about it because those two chapters were too big. too much other important stuff to talk about. But yeah, I believe it's, I think lots of fictional writers will tell you, it's always good to like let your own characters drive the story and everything. Mm-hmm. And I don't really know if it's the characters so much for him, but it's some sort of creativity that he's only loosely in control of himself, I would say, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But so this is 1944, right? Now, supposedly though, there were a couple drafts or outlines of the first Minas Tirith chapter, you know, with Pippin and Gandalf, and then this Muster Rohan chapter that we just read. Not the Grey Company chapter, that's chapter two. That wasn't written yet, and it wasn't in existence before Tolkien stopped in, like, late 1944. So those drafts and outlines, he starts iterating, like, the same scenes over again. And for a while, Aragorn's with Théoden's army at first, but then all of a sudden he isn't. But Tolkien doesn't know why, because the paths of the dead aren't a concept yet.
Okay.
But he's thinking, maybe Aragorn should go somewhere else, but I don't really know. Anyways, there was like a point where Christopher Tolkien, that's the son that's editing the whole thing, he says his dad was thinking with the pen, just jotting ideas down, which, you know, it's actually highly convenient for our review process, you know, to see what he was thinking and everything.
Right.
We can't get into all the details because it's way too long. Plus, it spoils stuff. We're the non-spoiler Tolkien podcast.
Uh-huh.
So he gets into a ton of proposed outlines for book five. His chapters, they seem just way too big compared to what it actually turned out to be. Like, he was just packing a bunch of stuff into a chapter, and it's like, dude, that's going to be like three chapters. What, you know? And in hindsight, it's like, what were you thinking? But, you know, he got to it eventually too. But some of the examples of this was because he didn't have all the essentials of the Return of the King yet. Like, it took him multiple outlines to figure out, wait, Aragorn's going to take a different mountain route, and why he was going to take a different mountain route took even longer to figure out. And then he finally starts envisioning Minas Tirith as like the city with like the seven circles, but originally it doesn't have the huge outcrop of rock on it yet. you know, which is the other kind of signature part of it. So that's kind of crazy. But anyways, then that's where we get another dead period. And we've already had at least one that was 2 years long, but this is another 2 year dead period. So we jump all the way to like late 1946. He just hasn't wrote anything for 2 years. I don't know. I don't think it was too much having to do with like war or anything or school. I don't really know what would cause the break. I mean, there was definitely things that could have, but I don't think it was anything serious or major that caused it. Like his family was healthy and everything. So,
I mean, it could be like he wasn't directly involved with anything related to the war then, but it was definitely a pretty chaotic time period, right?
Yeah. Some. I feel like the time period before was even more chaotic. Like, yeah, so in Britain. Like 41 to 44 was like the god awful time, I think.
That's true. Okay.
I don't really know. Yeah. Without being on the ground, I guess. But anyways, he starts finally writing again, and he gets the Ministeriath chapter done. But he just gotta work on the geography of the whole place, and Baragon's name was something else first. I think it was Beryn for a while. It was kind of funny. But then the chapter, I don't know, that chapter, we've already talked about it for two episodes, so let's just skip that one. He finally starts breaking out the Grey Company, and he's going to have Aragorn take the paths of the dead, but, like, figuring out, there was, like, the prophecy with it. See, this is the problem that we took this massive break, because I can barely remember the prophecy anymore. But I remember in the chapter itself, there was a prophecy from that Melbeth guy. It took him a while to figure out what exactly that should say or what's the meaning of it or whatnot. Anyways, I was skimming really fast. And then I also didn't see anything super, super interesting for this chapter. So I figured we should just jump into it unless, you know, you got anything else you would want to say.
Yeah, no, that sounds good.
All right, how did we feel about this chapter?
This is a pretty cool one. It's obviously, it's like a prep chapter. It totally in service of things that are about to happen. Unlike Pippin hanging out in Gondor, here we've got Merry hanging out in Rohan. It's kind of a parallel chapter in a lot of ways,
right?
I thought, but just a satisfying one at that, you know? Like, nice descriptions of the people and the landscapes and gearing us up, getting us in the mindset for what's about to go down.
Well, they were like gearing us up, but then it wasn't super, super hype, because they were very ominous, you know. And
yes,
I don't know, you'll get the feel of that this entire time. So we could probably talk about that more at the end, what we kind of make of that. Because I don't know if I really have a set opinion on that, so we'll see.
I feel like there's the moment of back in Gondor of Pippin and Baragon staring at the storm brewing in the east.
Right.
This is not exactly the same thing, but it's that same feeling of like two people sitting calmly looking at this giant storm that's coming. That feels like the same level of foreboding going on in this chapter.
Yeah, but this one's a little bit more urgent because now they have to haul for like the next week to get to Minas Tirith in time. You know, they don't just get to wait. They have to like get there themselves. Yeah. All right, cool. Should we jump in?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. All right, cool. So let's see. So Pippin's day out in Gondor's ending when Rohan finishes their 3-day march through the hills and they get back to the foot of the White Mountains again. Because that was kind of confusing. I guess they weren't just traveling along the edge of the White Mountains the entire time. Even though I thought they were. Anyways, they might have been. Whatever. But anyways, they're further east now towards Edoras and then obviously towards Gondor. And this is the stretch that Aragorn and the Dúnedain did in like a day just on the open flat, I guess.
Right.
And so Merry, he's talking to Théoden a good amount of the trip, but you want to take that mid-paragraph?
But most of the time, especially on this last day, Merry had ridden by himself, just behind the king, saying nothing and trying to understand the slow, sonorous speech of Rohan that he heard the men behind him using. It was a language in which there seemed to be many words that he knew, though spoken more richly and strongly than in the Shire, yet he could not piece the words together. At times, some rider would lift up his clear voice in stirring song, and Merry felt his heart leap, though he did not know what it was about.
All right. What do you really quick? What do you think about that? Because this doesn't really fit into the rest of the the chapter, the outlook with like Mary, but
you've already alluded to this multiple times in the past, but the Rohirrim are seem to be Tolkien's vision of the Anglo-Saxons,
right?
Of like the pre-Frenchified Britain,
right?
And this feels like a clear reference to that. If the Shire is where Tolkien has like put potentially like a romanticized version of his childhood or something like that, or like a contemporary but rural England, pre-industrial England, this is like a hearkening back to an older version that is familiar yet also unrecognizable.
Yeah.
So it's kind of cool. It sounds very beautiful.
And later in the chapter, what is one person? What does one of the soldiers call Mary? Do you remember?
It's like Master Hobbitlan or something like that.
Actually, yeah, you're going to have to pronounce it.
I won't be able to do it. Master Holbitla.
Yeah. So that's kind of like, yeah. So, Tolkien had to, he probably recreated that word, you know, like went back in time, like, oh, this is what it would have been in Old English, you know, but like it's supposed to intentionally be like Hobbit in their own language because they kind of connect. And if we remember from the Errol special, they were from the far north, like up the river. So they potentially did come in contact with the Hobbits, which were originally from, like, settled on the Anduin River way before they migrated over the Misty Mountains. So they might have actually had contact before where they could have made up that name.
Before were in the places they are now.
Right, or taken the Hobbit's name of Hobbit. Or they both descended from the same language because they were, you know, around each other. Who knows? but yeah, that's definitely what he's trying to do with the connection there. Anyways, though, Mary, he's riding there. Overall, he's been pretty lonely for the past 3 days. He's worried about Pippin, Aragorn, Legolas, and Gimli. And he's almost even forgot Frodo and Sam exist because he hasn't even thought about them for so long. But then, anyways, there's a quick conversation between Théoden and Éomer. Éomer says they're pretty close to their destination, and then he's also quietly trying to advise old Théoden not to ride to war. Do we remember how old Théoden is?
I do not off the top of my head. I feel like he was in his 70s.
Yeah, he was 70 exactly. So
okay.
He's white and gray hair. This is like the one thing that the movie gets different. The movie makes him like 50 or maybe 55, you know, which is like, I don't know, maybe a fine change. But who is he supposed to be again? Let's just.
The old Beowulf.
Oh, yeah. He's old Beowulf. It's one of the coolest things that I've learned from this podcast was, oh, Théoden, he's Beowulf. Like Errol was young Beowulf and then Théoden's old Beowulf. So pretty sick. So anytime Théoden's doing anything, just imagine this is Tolkien using his imagination to say, this is what I imagine Beowulf would be like. Or I'm putting Beowulf into my story and playing with him, you know, almost fan fiction kind of stuff. So let's see. All right, so they get to this Dunharrow place and there's already troops there and they're gathering up because some messenger from Gandalf had already rode through 3 days ago. So it seems like there's the Harrowdale, which is the bigger area, and then there's Dunharrow, which is the small epicenter, kind of like the Deeping Coombe to Helm's Deep kind of thing, did you think? Yeah. And then I believe Dunharrow, are we going to say Dunharrow is just at the top of this huge cliff thing?
I interpreted it, yeah, as Dunharrow is like the actual fortress part, whereas Harrowdale is literally the valley that it's in.
Yeah, that's what I thought too. All right, so all the riders are gathering in the valley. It's cold and there's no fires or torches. Why is there no fires?
Yeah, they spotted one of the dark riders that flew over on a Nazgul.
Oh, yeah.
And so that was impetus for them not to gather on the plain and to kind of stay up in the foothills and stay dark.
Well, but as we know, they can't actually see, but their beasts can see, so that's bad.
Right.
Yeah. Well, all right, I guess it doesn't matter for him because he can't see and the beast can't count. Oh, I just gave it away. I guess it doesn't matter for him because he can't see, but why would other people in ancient times or medieval times not have fires?
I
gave it away.
You did give it away, but to avoid being able to tell how many people are gathered in a place.
Right, yeah.
The number of fires in a camp, you can kind of estimate how large of a troop it is.
Right, you just multiply the fires by like 8 or 10, however many you think you can fit around a fire, you know.
Uh-huh.
But Yeah. Yeah. So, all right. I blew that one. All right. Let's see. I'll take the next thing. Merry wondered how many riders there were. He could not guess their number in the gathering gloom, but it looked to him like a great army, many thousands strong. While he was peering from side to side, the king's party came up under the looming cliff on the eastern side of the valley, and there suddenly the path began to climb, and Merry looked up in amazement. He was on a road, the like of which he had never seen before, a great work of men's hands in years beyond the reach of song. Upwards it wound, coiling like a snake, boring its way across the sheer slope of rock. Steep as a stair, it sloped backwards and forwards as it climbed. Up it the horses could walk, and the wains could slowly be hauled. But no enemy could come that way, except out of the air, if it was defended from above. At each turn of the road, there was a great standing stone that had been carved in the likeness of men, huge and clumsy-limbed, squatting cross-legged, with their stumpy arms folded on fat bellies. Some, in the wearing of the years, had lost all features save the dark holes of their eyes that still stared sadly at the passers-by. The riders hardly glanced at them. The Pukulmen, they called them, and heeded them little. No power or terror was left in them. But Merry gazed at them with wonder and a feeling almost of pity as they loomed up mournfully in the dusk. After a while, he looked back and found that he had already climbed some hundreds of feet above the valley. But still, far below, he could dimly see a winding line of riders crossing the ford and filing along the road towards the camp prepared for them. Only the king and his guard were going up into the hold. All right, did you catch it?
Mm-hmm. Well, catch what?
No, you tell me.
I mean, sounds pretty cool. This is an interesting fortress.
Yeah.
Switchback, stone-cut pathway winding up, and then these kind of funky characters that the Pukulmen, I don't know what to compare them to.
They what? Sound
like, well, I'm thinking of references outside of Lord of the Rings.
Oh, well, no, think of references in Lord of the Rings.
They remind me of the, maybe like the carvings of dwarves at Moria or the Lonely Mountain. But I don't know, what am I missing?
No, I'm not going to tell you if you can't get it.
Oh, man. Oh. Tough. Yeah, the way that they're described, it makes me think of dwarves being carved somewhere.
Yeah, that's a good guess.
Particularly like the cross-legged sitting and the like kind of being stumpy and fat. Is like the men tend to represent themselves as like really dramatic, like the two over the mouth of the Anduin. Gateway that I'm forgetting.
Yeah, the Argonath.
Yeah, the Argonath, yeah.
Yeah. All right, well, so, you know, what's also weird here, too, is Aragorn and everybody with him, they went up here 2 days ago. So it's kind of weird that we've already been here, but now we're getting, like, the description of it, because they didn't give the description. They just said he went to the top of, you know, at Dunharrow, and Eowyn was there, whatnot. And then the Paths of the Dead are behind that, just like in the movie. But it's strange, yeah, very strange that we've already been here, but now we're getting introduced to it. That I actually thought, well, we'll get into it a little bit more, but I thought that was one slight miss on Tolkien's part, is that parts of this chapter is like, wait, we've already kind of done this. Like, it almost felt like we were backtracking, you know?
Mm-hmm.
At the top, Eowyn greets them, and she's wearing full armor, and Merry thinks she looks sad and stern. She fills them in that Aragorn's come and gone by the paths of the dead. Éomer is sad to hear that, says hope is dwindled, he assumes he's dead. Merry feels alone again because all his friends are doomed. but then he's summoned to the king to do esquire duties. But instead of waiting on Théoden, which is like, you know, with the esquire, the, what's another word? Page? What?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Is there another word that I'm forgetting?
No, there is a word.
Squire. There. Oh, esquire is squire. Never mind. That's okay, what I was thinking of. Yeah. All right. But anyways, Théoden, he just wants Merry to sit down and eat with him. So the royal family, they fill him in on what the paths of the dead are, and none of them can fathom why Aragorn went that way. There's some more lore about the Paths of the Dead, about some ancient Rohan king that heard a prophecy from some old man. It was all, like, cool, But I don't know. Like I was saying, it kind of just didn't work because we already have seen Aragorn come through the paths of the dead. Now, these characters don't know that, and we do. So it's more that interlacing stuff that he's been doing for all of Two Towers and all of Return of the King so far. But it's still, I don't know. This one just, it came up slightly flatter than it would have if we had just stuck with them the whole time and then saw Aragorn, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah. But then again, I don't really blame his choice of ordering. Do you? Or do you think the Aragorn chapter should have come after this one?
No, I think it makes sense because it's... I think it makes sense how it is. Because also, it's important that Aragorn, Legolas, and Gimli are moving fast. And, like, the time factor is, like, pressing on them. And they have to do something different.
Right. Yeah. Anyways, though, there was more about the Paths of the Dead that if you're super into the lore stuff, definitely read it. But we're going to skip that tonight and have some sort of time restraints. But with that said, we got a pretty massive chunk to go into here just because I thought it was freaking awesome. We're going to read it.
Presently, the captain of the guard thrust aside the curtain. "A man is here, Lord," he said, "an errand rider of Gondor. He wishes to come before you at once."
"Let him come," said Théoden.
A tall man entered, and Merry choked back a cry. For a moment it seemed to him that Boromir was alive again and had returned. Then he saw that it was not so. The man was a stranger, though as like to Boromir as if he were one of his kin, tall and grey-eyed and proud. He was clad as a rider with a cloak of dark green over a coat of fine mail. On the front of his helm was wrought a small silver star. In his hand he bore a single arrow, black-feathered and barbed with steel, but the point was painted red. He sank on one knee and presented the arrow to Théoden. "Hail, Lord of the Rohirrim, friend of Gondor," he said. "Hurgon I am, errand rider of Denethor, who bring to you this token of war. Gondor is in great need. Often the Rohirrim have aided us, but now the Lord Denethor asks for all your strength and all your speed, lest Gondor fall at last."
"The red arrow," said Théoden, holding it, "as one who receives a summons long expected and yet dreadful when it comes." His hand trembled. "The red arrow has not been seen in the mark in all my years. Has it indeed come to that? And what does the Lord Denethor reckon that all my strength and all my speed may be?"
"That is best known to yourself, Lord," said Hurgon. "But ere long it may well come to pass that Minas Tirith is surrounded, and unless you have the strength to break a siege of many powers, the Lord Denethor bids me say that he judges that the strong arms of the Rohirrim would be better within his walls than without."
"But he knows that we are a people who fight rather upon horseback and in the open, and that we are also a scattered people, and time is needed for the gathering of our riders. Is it not true, Hurgon, that the Lord of Minas Tirith knows more than he sets in his message? For we are already at war, as you may have seen, and you do not find us all unprepared. Gandalf the Grey has been among us, and even now we are mustering for battle in the east."
"What the Lord Denethor may know or guess of all these things I cannot say," answered Hurgon. "But indeed our case is desperate. My lord does not issue any command to you. He begs you only to remember old friendship and oaths long spoken, and for your own good to do all that you may. It is reported to us that many kings have ridden in from the east to the service of Mordor. From the north to the field of Dagor Laad there is skirmish and rumor of war. In the south the Haradrim are moving, and fear has fallen on all our coastlines, so that little help will come to us thence. Make haste, for it is before the walls of Minas Tirith that the doom of our time will be decided, and if the tide be not stemmed there, then it will flow over all the fair fields of Rohan, and even in this hold among the hills there shall be no refuge."
"Dark tidings," said Théoden, "yet not all unguessed. But say to Denethor that even if Rohan itself felt no peril, still we would come to his aid. But we have suffered much loss in our battles with Saruman the traitor, and we must think still of our frontier to the north and east, as his own tidings make clear. So great a power as the Dark Lord seems now to wield might well contain us in battle before the city, and yet strike with great force across the river, away beyond the gates of kings." but we will speak no longer counsels of prudence. We will come. The weapon take was set for the morrow. When all is ordered, we will set out. 10,000 spears I might have sent riding over the plain to the dismay of our foes. It will be less now, I fear, for I will not leave my strongholds all unguarded. Yet 6,000s, at the least, shall ride behind me. For say to Denethor that in this hour the King of the Mark himself will come down to the land of Gondor, though maybe he will not ride back. But it is a long road, and man and beast must reach the end with strength to fight. A week it may be from tomorrow's morn, ere you hear the cry of the sons of Arrow coming from the north.
A week, said Hergon. If it must be so, it must. But you are like to find only ruined walls in 7 days from now, unless other help unlooked for comes. Still, you may at the least disturb the orcs and swarthy men from their feasting in the White Tower.
At the least we will do that, said Théoden. But I myself am new come from battle and long journey, and I will now go to rest. Tarry here this night, then you shall look on the muster of Rohan, and ride away the gladder for the sight, and the swifter for the rest. In the morning, counsels are better, and night changes many thoughts. All right. Pretty cool. What'd you think? Mm-hmm.
Definitely very intense, but also kind of funny, because it seemed like a formality, really, this whole conversation.
Yeah.
Like Gandalf has already really set this in motion, right?
Yeah.
That the Rohan's going to show up in Gondor.
Right.
Théoden already knows it. Gondor kind of already knows it too. And then even their discussion, like, I thought it was a little...
Well, there was that one line. There was that one line, a summons long expected and yet dreadful when it comes.
Yes, exactly. That's definitely captures it. But then even some stuff like they're almost bantering a little bit. In a very serious way, but Hergon's like, come to our castle. Théoden's like, are you sure you mean the castle? Like, wouldn't we really be better outside?
Yeah.
We fight better that way. And Hergon's like, it doesn't really matter, just come.
Right.
It's kind of like there's a formality of like they have to like politic through it a little bit first and debate the terms, and then they kind of agree to proceed.
Or spin zone. What if this isn't how the conversation actually took place, but this is how the writer wrote it hundreds of years later to make it sound really epic as they reforged the alliance or continued the alliance.
Okay. I mean, I'd buy it.
As a refresher, old friendship, odes long spoken. Do we remember where? We've already mentioned it tonight.
Yeah.
Where did it start?
With the, I don't remember his name, but the old friendship between... was it the first steward of Gondor?
Close. He was like
12th steward.
Right. He was like the 12th steward, and he was one of the early ones. He's got kind of an easier name. Do you remember?
It's like it was with a C. Like,
yeah, it was Cyril. Kirion.
Kirion. Okay, yeah. Kirion, 12th steward of Gondor, befriended the king of Rohan at the time, whose name I also don't remember.
Well, he wasn't Rohan at that point. They were just in the north.
Oh, right. Okay, that's right. And he permitted that king to come and settle basically one third of Rohan, gifted it to him, made him king of that land, and as a result, they're basically bound to defend each other.
Yeah. So Arryl, he was the young guy because his dad died young. Oh, right. So it was okay. Arryl the young, he was like 20, which is the age Beowulf is when he's coming up. That tribe had like a loose association and been friends with Gondor, kind of, but then Gondor was in a desperate hour, so Kirion sent messages up to him, and then Arryl thought about it, and he's like, I don't think we can live in a world without Gondor, or else we're going to be in trouble. So then he came and helped him, and then, there was, as a reward, Kirion gave him Rohan, the whole land that they have now. So, yeah, and perpetual friendship in both directions. So, yeah. Did you pick it up? There was one somewhere before in this chapter that I don't think we read, but Théoden's kind of predicting there's a good chance he's not coming back from this one. He basically said that. Though maybe he will not ride back, and he is himself, referring to himself in third person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like he's landed on pretty thick with that in this chapter.
Right.
Like numerous references to, I might not return from this one.
Right, or he predicted I'll never see Aragorn again. Who knows which way that goes, but
right.
Yeah. So anyways, oh, here is one thing though that I slightly upset about. Maybe it's actually kind of cool, but This is the first mention I've ever heard of the red-tipped arrow. Now, maybe some bigger dork's going to go, you know, can catch me that it was talked about somewhere. But, you know, when this book was released, all these details, like the red-tipped arrow, were cool because they were kind of mysterious because you didn't know that what their backstory was, but you did know that they had a backstory, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, you read Unfinished Tales, Silmarillion, all the histories of Middle-earth, all that stuff starts to get explained. But I think a notable exception might be this red arrow. I don't think I've ever come across, you know, what's the explanation with that? Like, it didn't come up with Kirion and Errol, I don't think, you know.
Yeah, when it was first mentioned, I thought for a second that it was like an orc arrow or something.
Right.
That was being brought as a sign that the fighting has started or something. But yeah. It seemed, the way Théoden received it, it implied that it was like a historic symbol.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of nice that, you know, that's just one of the unsaid mysteries, because it is kind of nice to have those too, you know.
Yeah.
Or at least in my opinion, I would say. But also important, Merry was here for this. He was pretty pumped up by this summons, and he vows that he's not going to be left behind. All right. Very important for the rest of the chapter, obviously.
Mm-hmm. And when you say vows, though, it's kind of like he's repeating this to himself as he's going to bed.
Yeah.
Not like he tells Théoden, like, right, I'm not being left behind.
Yep. Right. All right, so Merry, he's woken up by Rohan's soldier because he summoned a Théoden. Merry notes that it's still dark, and the guard says there won't be a sunrise today. Thick, thick, dark clouds are covering the sky. So if you're following the timelines really closely, you can tell where the other storylines are at. Do you remember, with all of your memory, where Frodo and Sam would be right now?
Is this right at the point where they are turning from the crossroads?
Yes.
Uphill, yes. Towards very the good steps?
Okay. They might not have been turning. I think it was like the day before they turned, but yeah, they were right around the crossroads.
Wasn't it that when they stood at the crossroads after they saw the head that we did the poem Ozymandias for?
Yeah.
They saw what was basically the last sunset.
That was the last sunset.
For a long time. And it was like all fiery red.
You're right. Yeah. Okay. All right.
Aragorn, so presumably that moment was the night before, right? When the rider would have showed up in Rohan.
Correct. Yes. So they're somewhere right around the crossroads now, or walking towards Minas Morgul. So.
Okay.
And then Aragorn and company.
They're already out on the other side, right?
Yeah. I think it was right when the chapter ended. They're just like, they were either hinting or it was that day that, yeah, there was no sunrise today.
Okay.
No. It wasn't just dark because they were traveling with dead people. It was dark because of this. And then Gandalf and Pippin.
Gandalf and Pippin, likewise, they're in Gondor.
Yeah. It ended the night before this starts, so.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, so the next day they wake up, there won't be a dawn, just like how Merry woke up today.
Uh-huh.
Oh, this is where my epic recording came in for the week. So
okay.
Merry saw many folk standing, looking up and muttering. All their faces were gray and sad, and some were afraid. With a sinking heart, he made his way to the king. Hirgon, the rider of Gondor, was there before him, and beside him stood now another man, like him and dressed alike, but shorter and broader. As Merry entered, he was speaking to the king. "It comes from Mordor, lord," he said. "It began last night at sunset. From the hills in the east fold of your realm, I saw it rise and creep across the sky. And all night, as I rode, it came behind, eating up the stars. Now the great cloud hangs over all the land between here and the mountains of shadow, and it is deepening. War has already begun." For a while, the king sat silent. At last he spoke. "So, we come to it in the end," he said, "the great battle of our time, in which many things shall pass away. But at least there is no longer need for hiding. We shall ride the straight way and the open road, and with all our speed. The muster shall begin at once, and wait for none that tarry. Have you good store in Minas Tirith? For if we must ride now in all haste, then we must ride light, with but meal and water enough to last us into battle." "We have very great store long prepared," answered Hergon. "Ride now as light and as swift as you may." "Then call the heralds, Éomer," said Théoden. "Let the riders be marshaled." Éomer went out. And presently the trumpets rang in the hold and were answered by many others from below, but their voices no longer sounded clear and brave as they had seemed to Mary the night before. Dull they seemed and harsh in the heavy air, braying ominously.
Nice.
Oh, thanks.
That's a good one.
Yeah, I thought this was, I don't know, it was pretty tough. I knew I was picking something that Théoden said, but I didn't exactly know which one. And then I thought this one was best because I wouldn't have to cut anything off. Like, the other one was way too long to do by myself. But yeah, all right, what do we think of that from a story perspective? I guess we'll do the competition part when we listen to yours.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of just piling it up. This is a second messenger, right, who's basically saying the same thing as the previous one, just with more urgency now. And has happened to arrive with this large cloud.
Right. Yeah, he explains the cloud to him. But it's more urgent now because now Théoden, I guess maybe we'll hear about it in a second or we'll skip over it. Anyways, Théoden's going to actually switch up his plan. Like, he was going to plan to be a little bit more measured, but now he's like, all right, I'll caution the wind. Open straightway. We're going to carry just enough stuff that we can get there in time to do battle. So he is actually planning to shorten the time from like a week to probably, I don't know if we're going to exactly read it, but it's like, I think 5 days, maybe 4 or 5 days. Okay. I guess we could look at the timeline. We'll get back to you on what the timeline is now. But, you know, they're going to go to Edoras and they're not going to stop there at all. They're just going to keep going, you know? Let's see. Okay. All right. So then, surprise, surprise, Théoden, he comes over, he talks to Mary, he breaks the bad news to him that he's not going to go to Gondor. Basically, because the pony won't be able to keep up because they're going to plan to haul ass now. So Mary's distraught. He's saying he can't be left behind. While all his friends are already all away, they're going to all be there. So Mary begs and begs and begs, and he says he'll run after him if he has to. And Théoden seems to somewhat relent because he changes his mind, and he says, well, all right, Mary, you can at least ride the pony to Edoras with us because the pony can keep up through the hills until we get out there, you know? And then Eowyn offers to give Mary some of the gear to be dressed for battle. All right, I read somewhere, and I didn't catch the detail myself, but did you catch it? Did Aragorn leave the gear for Mary? One of the books said that. Did you catch that?
I didn't pick that up. I just said that Aragorn requested that Mary should be armed.
Right, so did Aragorn leave it?
Not that I can tell.
Yeah, I don't think it... Yeah, I can't really tell that either. All right, well, anyways, Aragorn might have a hand in Mary getting armed, I guess, since he requested it at the least. So Eowyn, she gives him the gear, and then she says farewell, but that they might meet again, too. Okay, so that was... But then we got one, or almost one, the last big section for the night. I'm going to assume your thing's in here somewhere.
Probably so.
All right, well, now we need to know so we can figure out how to divide how to read it. Did you just do the song? I'm going to guess you just did the song.
I did just do the song.
Okay, that's what I figured. All right, so why don't you start off reading why don't you read the two smaller paragraphs, and then I'll jump in for the larger one, and then the bottom paragraph, and then we'll cut straight to your song.
All right, sounds good. So it was that amid a gathering gloom, the King of the Mark made ready to lead all his riders on the eastward road. Hearts were heavy, and many quailed in the shadow. But they were a stern people, loyal to their lord, and little weeping or murmuring was heard. Even in the camp in the hold where the exiles from Edoras were housed, women and children and old men. Doom hung over them, but they faced it silently. 2 swift hours passed, and now the king sat upon his white horse, glimmering in the half-light. Proud and tall he seemed, though the hair that flowed beneath his high helm was like snow, and many marveled at him and took heart to see him unbent and unafraid.
There on the wide flats, beside the noisy river, were marshaled in many companies, well nigh 5 and 50 hundreds of riders, fully armed, and many hundreds of other men with spare horses, lightly burdened. A single trumpet sounded. The king raised his hand, and then, silently, the host of the Mark began to move. Foremost went 12 of the king's household men, riders of renown. Then the king followed with Éomer on his right. He said farewell to Eowyn, above, in the hold, and the memory was grievous. but now he turned his mind to the road that lay ahead. Behind him, Merry rode on Stibba with the errand riders of Gondor, and behind them, again, 12 more of the king's household. They passed down the long ranks of waiting men with stern and unmoved faces. But when they had almost come to the end of the line, one looked up, glancing keenly at the hobbit, a young man. Merry thought as he returned the glance, less in height and girth than most. He caught the glint of a clear gray eyes, and then he shivered, for it came suddenly to him that it was the face of one without hope who goes in search of death. On down the gray road they went beside the Snowborn, rushing on its stones. Through the hamlets of Underharrow and Upborn, where many sad faces of women looked out from dark doors, and so without horn or harp or music of men's voices, the great ride into the east began, with which the songs of Rohan were busy for many long lives of men thereafter.
From dark Dunharrow in the dim morning, with Thane and Captain rode Thangle's son. To Edoras he came, the ancient halls of the Mark Wardens mist enshrouded, golden timbers were in gloom mantled. Farewell he bade to his free people, hearth and high seat, and the hallowed places, where long he had feasted ere the light faded. Forth rode the king, fear behind him, fate before him. Fealty kept he, oaths he had taken, all fulfilled them. Forth rode Theoden. 5 nights and days, east and onward, rode the Aerlingus, through fold and fen march and the Furian wood, 6,000 spears to Sunlending, Munberg the mighty under Mindoluin, Sea King's city in the South Kingdom, foe beleaguered, fire encircled, doom drove them on, darkness took them, horse and horseman, hoofbeats afar, sank into silence, so the songs tell us.
All right, Clifford, I liked it. I gotta say, I thought it was daring to pick the song because it was very hard to figure out the rhythm to this one.
Yeah, listening to it again, I realized I don't think I really got the rhythm all that well.
I don't know. I don't think anybody could really get it that well, though. Like, I think I read that. They're like, yeah, it's pretty hard to figure out what the meter's supposed to be for this one.
Yes. But I was thinking after I read this, I was like, I just thought it was such a cool and classically Tolkien idea that he's like, thinking of a song that somebody wrote after about this moment. You know, it's, you've got all the, it's like that the fact that the song exists there and in the telling captures so many different dimensions. Like, it's referencing that this is being written at a later point in time, probably by someone else, reflecting back on this moment, that this moment has gone down in history. It's just a very cool aspect of the story.
So. Yep, we would be wrong if we didn't read that song.
Definitely.
Like, you can't not. So, yeah, all right. We got to pick a winner. Who won this week? I believe...
Listen to my reading again. I feel like I read this way too softly again. Too calmly.
Clifford, I can turn up your volume.
Okay.
So... Yeah. Well, actually, I thought mine was softer than the past 2 weeks. I didn't have as much gusto either. So.
We really need a third person for this voting.
Yeah, or we could just keep tying. I think the score right now is I'm at 1-0-1, and you're at 0-1-1.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. That sounds good.
So. Maybe, all right, well, here's what we could do. I'll vote for you for the win this week so that we just have, like, an even thing.
1-1-1?
I would actually probably vote for yours this week because, like, yeah, this was it's a hard song, and then, yeah, it's probably the right thing to pick. And then after that, if we can, if we have it in us to have the recordings done sooner than 15 minutes before we record, we can send him off to Morgan and she can just pick who wins.
Okay. I like that.
Yeah.
Fair enough. I liked your reading this week, but I will vote for myself to win this one.
Yeah. Let's do that. So then.
Okay.
All right. So now we're at 1-1-1 and we have a prospect for the future.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, now we probably forgot what we already read, but what did we think of that passage?
well, as noted, the song is very interesting because it's reflecting back on this moment from a later point in time. But right. Basically, this is the... It's both, like, very cool and inspiring, but a super gloomy. I'm envisioning, like, totally, like... It's not actively raining, but this it has the sensation of, like, it's totally dark and people are marching silently out into the rain.
Yeah, it's... It makes sense in a way, but then it's also unexpected. And by in a way, I mean completely. But it's unexpected because, I don't know, you... Like, the past two chapters, we kind of got jacked up. Like, you know, stuff's happening in Minas Tirith. And then Aragorn, I mean, the way he just commanded the ghosts, it's just... It's another one of those. It was another one of those passages where, like, if your heart's not pumping, you don't have a soul. I've said that before about stuff with this. I'll say it again. But here, it's like... It's almost like Tolkien's trying to... tamp down a bit, you know, like he's trying to restrain us, even though we're getting so pumped because like everybody's going to Minas Tirith for the greatest battle of the age, you know, like the battle of our time, as Théoden said. But I don't know, very hopeless, relatable in Tolkien's life. There's probably just the obvious example. Don't just nod. You gotta say what it is.
Nobody sees
you nodding, okay. Clifford.
I didn't realize you were floating that as a question. Going off to World War II, right?
Well, World War I, but yeah.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Well, Clifford. It hasn't been that long a break. I don't know.
No, but at this point, as he's writing this, people have also gone off to World War II.
Right? Yeah, but it's probably relatable for himself when he went off to World War I. Okay, because that, fair enough, that fair felt enough. Like real death. Like, I don't know, potentially worse than this, but yeah. Because by the time he went, it was like 1916. It's like, all right, we know what this is. You know, this is going to be bad.
Right, right. Okay.
And I guess Rohan, I guess maybe Rohan can know that too, since they already fought with Saruman a bunch, but I don't know. Gandalf saved the day. That went pretty excellent. And actually, Helm's Deep, they lost a lot of men, I guess. Maybe. I feel like there's more to say about that, but maybe we're not capable. And I didn't actually read too much about it either, but...
I don't know. It feels like... Maybe it's just my reading of the chapter, but it felt like everything in this chapter is very gloomy and dark, but it's not the same weight that we felt at other points, at other chapters and other points in time. Like, definitely, like, the total despair that, or weight of the world that Frodo has felt, for instance, is not coming close to this. Or this is not coming close to that. This feels like... things are not awesome, but everybody's really, like, there's a lot of resolve here.
Okay.
It feels like a really hardy crowd, and I think that's, to me, that's part of it, is, like, they're not really upbeat, but they're not lacking for like, determination and thinking that they can do what they needs to be done.
Yeah, do you think morale's lower here, or when the fellowship broke? Like, or, like, as it was about to break? Because, like, that whole week in the boats, they had just left Lothlorien, and then it hit them again that Gandalf had died, you know? So, I mean, there was, like, a stretch where there was about 9 chapters of not good news until Gandalf came back, you know?
Right. I think morale was lower then. I think...
Yeah.
The only reason morale is low now is because people see their deaths ahead of them. But they're not, like... what am I supposed to be doing in this world type thing? Like, they have a really clear sense of purpose.
Yeah.
Gandalf has geared them up for the idea that they're already going to battle. The troops are mustered. It's like they I'm sure feel like they're part of the gears in this larger story already.
Yeah.
Like, they're fulfilling this ancient summons to help Gondor in need and all that. Like, if, I don't know, it just feels like there's a lot, they already kind of sense that they're in a story. Is maybe another reason that song is included.
Right. My favorite lines from this song were, "Forth rode the king, fear behind him, fate before him, fealty he kept, oaths he had taken, all fulfilled them." You know, so it's like the king's got the duty. For 500 years, Rohan's been loyal to Gondor, and this is, you know, this is a bound oath. Perpetual friendship, you have to answer this. So the king has to go, and you guys are all loyal to the king because you all swore personal oaths to him, and you swore, and the peasants below him swore oaths to their lord and stuff. And so now they're all going, and they all fulfilled the oath. Like, there's nobody that was like a coward and stayed behind or anything. They were all doing what the king said, and they're ready to go. where this is, even though, yeah, they're not looking forward to this at all. They don't expect this to be a triumphant end, at least at this point. Yeah.
They're like, all right, coach, taking one for the team here. I'm going in.
Do we, maybe we could draw on this again too, because I thought it was cool at the time. And soon I'll be editing the episode. But it was when the messengers got to Errol, when we did that episode about how they became friends and stuff, Errol, his response was basically, you know, he saw that Gondor was in trouble, like on the brink of destruction, even unless his people came to help out. And he just thought about it for a little bit, but it didn't take him too long. But he just said, I'm going to go help these people because there's something about Gondor where, like, if they perish, what can the rest of the world do? You know?
Right.
And it's still kind of applicable today. And so we had said, well, what did Gondor represent in that scene? And whatever it was, is probably still the same here. You know, it's some sort of, in Middle Earth, it's like, well, they represent like the highest people, you know, the Numenoreans, like the ones that are in touch with the goodness, the most goodness of Valinor across the sea and everything like that, you know? And so then whatever you want to say Gondor represented in the Western medieval world, like some great kingdom or something, you know, like you can kind of translate it there too. Like that's what Errol was defending. And then 500 years later, that's what his descendant Théoden is going about and doing too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, pretty cool. All right. So anyways, let's finish this off though. They get to Edoras at noon to do some last stock ups, but it's still dark, obviously, because we said it's not going to dawn this day. You think it's super dark or only like kind of dark?
I'm thinking like one of those full on really nasty thunderstorm days.
Yeah.
Dude, you can still see outside, but it's like there's clearly no sun.
Maybe I'm like at a complete memory loss, but those are like so much more severe in like the South or the Midwest. Like, I don't really remember those in Colorado where it would get really, really dark, you know? Like, I don't think
that's a very classic Midwestern thing, is like that heavy, humid air. We don't get them at all out here.
Right.
I've never seen them in the mountains either.
Yeah. I was like surprised because I've been back for like a month now, but I mean, it's like, oh, right. I forgot it gets this dark. No wonder I was scared of thunderstorms when I was like three.
Right. You know? It feels way more like a freight train rolling across the sky, whereas like I feel like out west with mountains or the ocean, it's like so much more sporadic.
All right, so now Théoden, this is when he lays down the law. He firmly tells Merry goodbye, and he doesn't budge an inch with any of like the last pleadings that Merry has. We're not going to read it, but did you have any thoughts about that?
It's unfortunate for Merry. Théoden kind of makes up a couple different things, like your horse is too small, you're too small, you can't really do battle. Seems like he doesn't want to come out and say it, but he's kind of like, you're just going to get killed. You're not going to contribute to this fight.
Well, you're also going to weigh somebody else down.
Right.
You know, yeah.
It's a pretty unfortunate thing for Merry to be hearing.
Yeah. But it's too bad. All the males are just so big in this army.
Uh-huh.
There's just no one he could ride with. All right, but anyways, what I really thought was, I thought this was actually slightly uncharacteristic of Théoden from everything that we've seen of him, because he's been so, even though he's Beowulf, who's in the top echelon of badasses of all history, he's been very warm and personal to the hobbits, or personable to the hobbits that he's met him, but here he comes off as kind of impersonal or stern. To Merry, at least. I guess he's gotten pissed like at Saruman and stuff in the last book, but yeah. So I don't know. I thought that just came off as yeah, that sounds like a dad.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like there's, I mean, yeah, I think most people can relate. There's a point where the dad's just, every dad's like super firm with you, like, nah, you can't do that. Decision's made. I'm not changing my mind. You gotta stick with it just so that I can show you who's boss anyways. But there's also better reasons beyond that too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that was kind of, I think we had brought that up in one of the other chapters, how Thaden's pretty becomes like a father figure to Mary. I think he even said that. Mary even said, like, you'll be like an adopted father to me for the rest of this trip, like when he swore allegiance to him last chapter, I believe. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Although notably, maybe notably, at the start of this chapter, Théoden is writing to Éomer as they're riding into the valley and says to Éomer, like, he says, son, and I'll call you that, or something along those lines where he's referring to Éomer as a son as they're about to ride into battle together.
Well, as he should. I mean, he is the heir because Théoden's son had died and Aemir's his nephew.
Right, right. Yeah. But it's, I think it's like emblematic of where Théoden's mind is at.
Right, you know? Right. Yep, definitely. All right, let's see. Okay, so there's a pretty... you can't not read this part. Do you want to take Mary bowed?
Mary bowed and went away unhappily and stared at the lines of horsemen. Already the companies were preparing to start. Men were tightening girths, looking to saddles, caressing their horses. Some gazed uneasily at the lowering sky. Unnoticed, a rider came up and spoke softly in the hobbit's ear. Where will wants not, a way opens, so we say, he whispered, and so I have found myself. Mary looked up and saw that it was the young rider whom he had noticed in the morning. You wish to go whither the Lord of the Mark goes? I see it in your face.
I do, said Mary.
Then you shall go with me, said the rider. I will bear you before me under my cloak until we are far afield, and this darkness is yet darker. Such goodwill should not be denied. Say no more to any man, but come.
Thank you indeed, said Mary. Thank you, sir, though I do not know your name.
Do you not? Said the rider softly. Then call me Durnhelm.
Ho-ho. Look at this. Surprise at the end of the chapter. I don't think we saw this coming, did we? this one's pretty hard not to see coming.
I know.
If you read it before you've seen the movie, I don't know. Like, we're having fun with it, but... And we won't give it away, but...
Yeah. A lot of hints are dropped.
There's just no way not to. I don't know. You know? And I guess we'll get into it more when the big reveal happens. But, this mysterious Durnhelm used this line, where will wants, a way opens. I bet that's another one of those old English sayings. Mm. And, like that's probably pretty authentic. And Tolkien just throws it in because, or saying or proverb, I guess their version of proverbs. So yeah. All right. Well, that's cool. So Mary's going to get to go apparently, which is good. Cause we need a character in Rohan. All right. We got to follow these people. Cause I don't think we're going to get, you know, Beowulf's perspective himself. So we got to have the guy that's watching Beowulf do something awesome. So, and Beowulf's nephew.
That's a great point. Yeah, the kind of third person personal narrative style of the whole book has to be carried through by having someone from the Fellowship present,
right,
to help record what's going on.
Yeah, and it's always, and he likes using the weaker character's point of view, or seemingly weaker character's point of view.
Right. Like, he'll only pivot to Aragorn if there's not someone else around, or right, something like that, right?
Like last chapter, yeah, he did Aragorn for like a page or two, and then he switched over to Gimli, you know, right away, as quick as he could. Right. So, yeah, and he might have done Gandalf for like a page, but like he never does Gandalf, never does Legolas either. I think he avoids elves. Elves are way too cool and mysterious. He's got to get more human people that are relatable.
But, yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did that whole thing is that, I mean, we've mentioned it a little bit before, but I think that's actually a very significant piece of the whole story, is that writing style. But anyways, very good plot reason for Mary to keep going.
Yeah, I'm glad he does, because spoilers, it's freaking awesome. I'm so pumped. It's possibly my favorite part to be revealed later, because I do know what my favorite part is. all right, but anyways, there's one last chunk tonight. They're all gonna ride on, but ominously they start getting reports of the enemies attacking Rohan from possibly like further north, from like they cross the river to attack him. But it's a pretty fun finish, so I thought we would just read that for the night, and then, you know, that'll be the end. Sound good to you?
Mm-hmm.
Thus it came to pass that when the king set out, Before Durnhelm sat Meriadoc the Hobbit, and the grey steed Windfulla made little of the burden. For Durnhelm was less in weight than many men, though lithe and well-knit in frame. On into the shadow they rode, in the willow thickets where Snowborn flowed into the Entwash. 12 leagues east of Edoras they camped that night, and then on again through the fold, and through the fen marsh, where to their right great oak woods climbed on the skirts of hills under the shades of dark Halifarion, by the borders of Gondor. But away to their left the mist lay on the marshes, fed by the mouths of Entwash. And as they rode, rumor came of war in the north. Lone men, riding wild, brought words of foes assailing their east borders, of orc hosts marching into the wold of Rohan.
Ride on, cried Éomer. Too late now to turn aside. The fens of Entwash must guard our flank. Haste now we need. Ride on.
And so King Théoden departed from his own realm, and mile by mile the long road wound away, and the beacon hills marched past. Calahed, Minraman, Arilas, Nardinal. But their fires were quenched, all the lands were gray and still, and ever the shadow deepened before them, and hope waned in every heart. Okay, all right, Clifford, we're back again.
Indeed we are.
How was your three-day weekend?
It was wonderful. I love three-day weekends so much. I went skiing yesterday.
Ooh, where at?
Nice. In Tahoe. Ooh. Lake Tahoe. Yeah, pretty fancy. So a real amazing, unique benefit of living out here. I can drive into winter and then back out of it again.
Yeah.
In one day.
Yeah.
Nowhere else I've ever been. Is that possible?
You could do that in Colorado, for
Fair.
Sure.
Okay.
But,
okay.
Yeah. Yeah. That one's nice. You any good at skiing? I guess you are, right?
Passable. I'm better than the beginners and worse than the experts. Somewhere.
Can you do the blues?
Yeah.
I can
do the blues. I can do some of the blacks if I'm feeling really, really confident.
Wait. Don't you snowboard?
I did for a while.
I knew it was a phase for you.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, so you can do the blues. See, I can't do the blues. That's where I'd tap out. Okay. I can do the greens, but the blues I have to fall to stop. So
that's about it. Hazel's kind of in that phase, and I've been trying to get her caught up so that she has fun and isn't miserable.
Nice. Cool. Well, I don't know. Do we have anything else for this week? I think that we could actually just keep this one short. It's not short by any means, but
sure. It's fine by me.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for listening, everybody. We're going to stop it here. Send us reviews. Your time's ticking away. So, we want to read some more too. All right. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Thanks, y'all.